Guaranteed to be worth the wait for a change. Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
Say on the record, the following intro is under review. VAR will have a check. We'll come back in about an hour's time. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 290 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighbor host, Dre Harrison. And, we got some good stuff to get to here. It comes at the end. Unfortunately, we have to get through the Daytona 500 first. It's ironic. We came off the a pretty interesting NASCAR movie, to say the least, last time out. We tried with this year's Daytona 500.
Yeah,
we tried.
We gave it a good old try.
The good old close try.
It seems that if we get a good 24, we get a pretty crap 500 and vice versa.
Yeah, it seems to be one way or the other. We'll break down how it all turned out. We've got a little bit of interesting Formula One news to get through. And in the second half of the show, we'll be talking all about Formula E's 2021 season preview. We go team by team as we go up and down the field as their season starts. Next weekend, I think it's the 26th, I want to say.
27th, Dre.
Yeah, double header in Saudi Arabia to start off the season. And we'll break all of that down going into the second half of the show. But with me, this, as always, RJ O'Connell. Hello, sir.
I truly hope that by the time this episode comes out that the state of Texas will have thawed out. And that maybe some of the people in charge can, think about the choices that have put their people in this position to begin with. Just a thought.
A very wholesome thought indeed. Stay safe down there in Texas. From this Brit from across the pond. As well, Ryan King. Hello, sir.
Hello. About to get hit by another big snowstorm here in New York, and everything's just going to be just fine.
Oh, here comes King with that smug blue checkmark energy.
Oh, yeah. He's got gritters and stuff. Everything will be fine in New York. They get three of these a year.
Three.
Smug git. And also with me is Cam Buckley. Hello, sir.
Hello, everyone. I'm also going to be getting that snowstorm. And unlike King, who's confident about it, I live on a cliff. Real fun to get down the driveway in the morning.
That ain't good. Do you just like roll yourself down the hill and hope for the best? Like it doesn't become like a barren and snowball by the time you're halfway down.
No, I just get to the top and crouch down and then spin dash like Sonic.
You see, it's a metaphor for the number of green flag overtakes in this year's Daytona 500.
Big oof. We'll be talking about the Daytona 500 very briefly. We've also got Formula One news. Again, we could be seeing another weekend format change. Kinda. Sorta. Yes, if you think you've heard this before, you probably have. But this one is actually looking like it's probably going to happen. More on that soon, as well as Red Bull finally revealing what they're doing with their power units next year. And of course, as mentioned, the Formula E 2021 Season 7 preview later on as well. But places you can find us in the meantime, we're on youtube.com/motorsport101. We're on facebook.com/motorsport101. If you're watching us on YouTube, hi, subscribe, hit the bell if you haven't already. If you're not, our Twitter handles are at Harrison101HD, at RJ O'Connell, at Ryan Eric King, and at CBuckley917. As I said, on the screens right now, if you're watching on YouTube, our podcast itself is Motorsport_101. We're on Instagram, at Motorsport101Pod for all updates on our content over there. And if you really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/Motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our audio shows. You can upgrade to $10 for the video versions and access to the supporters club of our Discord server where you can listen to these episodes live as they go out. Shout out to Tony, Finley, Jason, Sasha, who's currently celebrating Man City's goats coming back in one fell swoop. Lucky git. Vikesh and Zoe. Have a good one, guys. Enjoy the show. You can find all those details and a whole lot more on our website, motorsport101.com. So, without further ado, let's get into the news. So, fellas, let's just say everything about the Daytona 500 pretty much didn't go to plan. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that would be a fair assessment.
It was the perfect way to start the best season ever.
Oh man, if this is what they're calling the best season ever, we're in big trouble. It started off at 3 p.m., as was very controversial on Twitter, because we knew days in advance that it's going to rain pretty much all late afternoon on Sunday.
But think about that prime time viewing window, Cam. We got to get that prime time viewing window for the finish.
No.
What prime time?
And we can't
what
have,
viewing?
And we, can't have the, yeah, the... and we can't have the West Coast waking up at, no, 9 a.m. I mean, who wakes up at 9 a.m. for a race in the United States?
Though, you know, admittedly, I don't fan. Know where anywhere in the world where before 8 p.m. is prime time.
Certainly not here.
They time it in with factoring in red flags for crashes.
Oh, they just assume. Oh. They just assume. Yeah, we're gonna have to stop this race.
Yeah, but
that's always a good sign.
Yeah. Race started. We were under the threat of rain pretty much immediately, and the drivers knew they had to get all they could get. Well, on lap 15, shit got bad real quick, and I think 16 of the 40 something cars got wiped out in a single crash, including
the pole sitter Alex Bowman.
Yeah, the pole sitter and outside pole sitter, former outside pole sitter due to the move to a backup car. A lot of good cars got wiped out.
Yeah, not to name names, but Christopher Bell, we're looking at you. We're looking at you.
Yeah. When you have a run and you're about to hit someone on a plate track at a bad angle, you don't go through with it.
Yeah, this becomes very important later on in the race. Although I will say, this pileup did give us some good content. Tyler Reddick came back with a car that was just, I don't know how to describe it, but suffice to say, he had accidentally turned his Cup Series car into a Whelen modified.
Yeah, imagine being at one of the most aerodynamically dependent tracks in all of motorsport, honing your car for months in a wind tunnel, and you get passed by a car with no front end.
How did that happen?
Yeah, on the downside, car falling apart, William Byron did manage to get his car fixed, but not enough to make sure that bits of it didn't fall off directly into the path of journeyman driver Quinn Huff and ruining his race. Oh. When he probably should have been parked two laps prior.
Yeah, and after that happened, and we had the aftermath of that crash, the rains came down and didn't stop coming down for about 6 hours.
I was at the point where I was just like, buddy, call this race, push it back to tomorrow, and let these people go on with their lives. Most of the drivers were off taking photos of themselves at nice chain sit-down restaurants.
Oh, Lord. Didn't Ross Chastain go to McDonald's?
He did. He ordered the McDonald's for his entire team.
Someone had McDonald's. Someone went to Panda Express. Someone went to Cheddar's, which is basically like a more southern version of Applebee's.
Yeah.
Is the way I would describe it.
Does everything there have cheese?
Amazingly not.
I also love that two of our Europeans in our Discord, Finley and Jason, said, I went to bed.
Yeah. Buddy, that was a smart move.
Yeah, by all accounts, we figured that this race was done on Sunday and would resume on 4 p.m. Monday on Fox Sports 1, thus destroying any ratings they might have achieved by starting the race at 3 p.m.
But see, here's the thing, Cam. Either decision they make, they are fucked in the ratings.
Yeah, they are. They made their own bed and they got to lay in it. But amazingly, we got enough of a break in the rainstorms to dry the track and get going just after 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
And was it worth it, Cam? Was it
absolutely
worth the
wait? Not. Because this race
yes!
was shit. We had, oh my god. So all the way towards the end of stage one, it was single file up near the wall behind the dominant car on the day, one of Mr. Denver Hamlin, going for three in a row.
Our old buddy.
Yes. Noted team owner and Jordan Brand athlete. That becomes important later. And it became a recurring theme of Hamlin leading. At the end of a stage, we'd get a little bit of passing, a little bit of action, and then as soon as the new stage would start, right back to single file.
Hamlin led 98 laps.
Yeah.
If this was a race where best car wins, Hamlin's a four-time winner of this event, which would have put him in very elite territory of himself, Richard Petty, Cale Yarborough, and nobody else in the history of the Great American Race registered trademark.
Yeah. His car looked like Dale Jr.'s 2015 plate car. He could do he could pass anyone he wanted. He could get to the front more or less at will.
But you know where it looked the most comfortable, as in most everybody's cars? The high groove.
Yep. The high groove, single file, up near the wall. And his car could pull that top lane so effectively that anyone dropping down to the bottom lane, you know, they could put a line together, but they couldn't get up to him. And then final pit stops happened. Because absolutely nothing happened in the meantime, let's skip to the final pit stop. Everyone
He's
pits.
Not making this up, by the way. He's not exaggerating any of this.
No. We get to the final pit stops. Of course, at play tracks, you pit in groups because you need drafting partners. The Gibbs cars all pitted together, and Hamlin had quite literally too good of a pit stop. He got out ahead of his teammates, and he lacked a drafting partner. He lacked momentum, and he got passed by the oncoming pack.
It is the weirdest thing that at super speedways where they clamp down on the horsepower, they don't use restrictor plates, they use what's called tapered spacers in the engines to slow the cars down. Ooh. That having a huge lead is the worst possible thing that could happen to you at a race like this, or at Talladega.
It's like you do everything right and it ends up being wrong.
Yeah, he ends up being shuffled back in the pack and never really made a move. And in the final few laps, we had death, taxes, blood, shit, other various fluids, Penske at the front in a 1-2 of Joey Logano and Brad Keselowski. Being followed by one Michael McDowell, the guy who's most famous for having one of the scariest crashes of the late 2000s, driving the Aaron's 00 car at Texas.
Yeah. For those who don't know, Michael McDowell is the definition of a NASCAR journeyman driver. He had spent years at start and park teams, which, as their name implies, show up to start the race, run a few laps, then park it and collect the prize money, which used to be a viable strategy. In other words, Michael McDowell was not very competitive for many, many years of his career. He is also probably lesser known for winning a Pro Mazda championship on the road to Indy, a cup of coffee and champ car as Ryan Hunter Ray's replacement at the end of 2005. Suffice to say, this man has had a long and arduous career, and it looked like he was never going to win a NASCAR Cup Series race after being at this game for 14 years.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Sasha and our Discord literally pointed, described him in one word, and the word was not even a real one. It was called unserious.
genuinely a decent driver, but just never, he's never had an opportunity at a top quality team. However, Front Row Motorsports, the team he drives for, who are never on the front row, they're always pretty solid at plate tracks.
Yeah, this is a team that once was a start and park operation. They were once field fillers. And I'm not going to tell you that they are a front-running organization, because they're not, but they are at the very least a plucky lower midfield team.
Yeah, they're always there. They don't even have to worry about qualifying. They're always in the mid-20s on most normal tracks.
But every time at a race like this, especially at a super speedway, because of the nature of the racing itself, a team like that has a fighting chance at a out-of-nowhere victory.
Yeah, because it's less about the quality of the equipment you're in and more about playing the game and being able to position yourself in a place to succeed. But we get to the final lap because there was so little action that they waited until the last run down the backstretch to make a move. We get a second lane. Joey Logano's in front. Keselowski's being pushed by McDowell, and oh no, someone someone puts it into a gap that isn't supposed to be there. Someone throws a block, and... Ugh.
Yeah, that was a scary wreck. It's always scary when I see a sudden burst of fire coming out of a pack of cars that's just being wadded up and chewed apart like they've just been run through the guts of Truckosaurus.
Yeah. Crash was nasty. Thankfully, no one hit in a place that would pose any danger to the drivers. Obviously, NASCAR Cup cars, if nothing else, are very, very safe. We didn't have a repeat of last year where someone took an actual stock car to the actual head.
Thank goodness for that. Nothing. Ryan Newman's race ended much earlier.
Yeah, Ryan Newman's race ended in the initial lap 15 pileup.
Yep.
So, we are left with only a handful of cars left going around turn 3 and turn 4. Michael McDowell is leading next to Chase Elliott, next to Austin Dillon, and they throw the caution to end the race.
Oh!
Michael McDowell is your 2021 Daytona 500 champion.
This has a habit of happening. First-time winners at the Daytona 500 every 10 years, because we had it with Waltrip in 2001, Trevor Bayne in 2011, and now McDowell in 2021. Yeah. And, I mean, I know that in retrospect, Michael McDowell probably... I don't even know if it was probably pushed Brad Keselowski in a run that he couldn't back out of. To take the win, but like that precedent was set when Austin Dillon quite literally dumped Eric Almirola into the turn three fence to win the Daytona 500.
Yeah, because dumping cars at super speedways in excess of 190 miles per hour is no longer taboo. Look, I'm not mad that Michael McDowell won the race. He seems like a genuinely good dude by all accounts, and watching someone get their first win is, it's always cool.
Especially when their first win is the Daytona 500.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good first win.
An incredibly boring race where not a whole lot happened, it was defined by two huge pileups. They couldn't even let us race back to the line when there was no one injured and there was no threat to the remaining cars of getting in another crash. Unless they caused it of their own volition.
Yeah, I don't know about that. It's typically been the play. If there's like a big pile up with half a lap to go, they will throw the yellow.
Not in the last couple of years. As long as it happens in a place where, gee, you're not going to have them going full speed back to the line into that wreckage.
Yeah, they let them race. Yeah.
It seemed like they didn't want to take the chance after what happened last year.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I didn't have a problem with that. My problem with this race is that it just generally wasn't worth waiting it out to see if they would restart it on that same day or not. I mean, all this was the infamously boring 2000 Daytona 500. Yep. Which had a grand total of, like, 5 green flag on-track lead changes. Only it didn't cock-tease an upset first-time winner like it did in 2000. Sup, John Benson Jr. Sup, Lycos.
The only thing, ironically, the only thing that generated any excitement before the final couple laps was people trying to make plays for stage points right at the end of stages. Were it not for those, we'd probably run single file.
And if it wasn't for Bubba Wallace having a legitimate shot to win until he had to pit, make an unscheduled stop for a loose wheel.
Yeah, Bubba looked great. He was running up in the top 5 for most of the race.
Didn't have a particularly good start, given his car failed inspection 3 times before it even started.
He lost his qualifying spot and had to fight his way up. But now that he's in some good equipment, he's showing what he can do.
Yeah, it's good enough that it has to go through inspection multiple times. In case you were worried about it, you're not trying.
Oh my god.
This race was bad.
This is probably the worst Daytona 500 I've watched and have cognitive memory of, because I was 3 in 2000.
Oh god.
So, yeah.
I think it's less right there
with, it's right there with 2013 of, dude, let something happen. Anything.
It was a dud.
It was a dud.
I'm happy for McDowell, but that race was a dud. And speaking of duds, Dre, we got some news about Formula One sprint races.
We do indeed. There was a meeting between Formula One's team principals last week. A range of topics were discussed. The other one we'll get to shortly. But one of the big takeaways that came out of it was what they were saying was universal agreement between the principals, which in and itself is somewhat of a miracle. Yes, they all agreed on something. I know, I'm as shocked as you are. But amazingly, what they agreed on was the concept of adding sprint races to the calendar. Now, hear me out here. This is a little vague because they haven't actually formulated a hard plan for this yet. That's what they're now going to go off and do. Everyone was like, sprint races? Does that sound good? And I was like, yeah, sounds all right. So how do we actually do these? I'll get back to you on that. So they're going to go off and formulate a hard plan, but the rumblings that was in the meeting were along the lines of a free race trial, probably later on in the year. I think the three rumoured circuits were Interlagos, Canada and Monza is where they could end up trying this out. You know, Canada, I think, is normally July. Interlagos is normally down the back.
That is a bold assumption that we're going to have all three of those races to begin with, but that's besides...
Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? The way COVID's going, God knows at this point. Your guess is as good as mine, but that's the provisional plan, and I mean the super provisional plan. They would have some form of smaller point system for these sprint races in general. Probably similar to something like what we get currently in Formula 2 and 3. Formula 2 specifically, because we all know they have sprint races, and I think they only give out 15 points for a win as opposed to the normal 25 for the feature and F1 races in general. So if I had to guess, something along those lines. They haven't worked out the format or the length of the race yet, and the other little things like how would the grid be formed, how tyre allocations would work out for something like that.
So they basically haven't decided anything.
We agree on the idea of it. Let's actually make a plan.
But
there's nothing concrete.
There's so many falling blocks where this could fall apart, where it's like, again, the idea of giving out reduced points. Like, yes, they've all agreed to that, but it's like, hey, is this race going to set the grid for the race? Or, like, there's so many places where this could fall apart and not happen, and this has happened so many times before that I'm not buying in until I see a concrete
once King is even more cynical than I am about this, and that's saying something because I'm normally more optimistic. It's nothing about this really is set in stone.
How many years have we been hearing about this?
This is like an alpha for a video game. It's not even like the beta you might get to publicly test. This is the alpha version.
This is like the current NSX of ideas, where we saw the idea 5 years before it actually happened, and we're all just like, just either go through with it or cancel it.
Yeah, and as King points out, I think King's spot on in the sense of there is a lot of potential dominoes along the way where this could, you know, self-destruct, i.e. the point system. Does it set Sunday's grid? What's the tyres going to look like? How long is the races going to be? You know, what does it do with engine parts? Because you could potentially be running cars for longer depending on how long the sprint race ends up being.
Yeah, because it's not so much the sprint races themselves, it's the effect it has on the rest of the weekend around it, and indeed the rest of the season around it.
Yeah, because there are so many dividing points where team principals have aired different opinions on what it should be. Where some people, where some team principals would like the idea of a reverse grid sprint race, and, you know, cited, you know, the W Series non-championship race as a great example of how it could be exciting. While other people, you know, Toto Wolff, say that reverse grids are too WWE for Formula One.
Yeah, I remember saying that last year.
Back to this. If there is some gimmick that pops up in racing that people don't like, let's compare it to pro wrestling. That's a fucking laziest line of reasoning.
I love how most times the WWE get brought up about any change being gimmicky is mainly because it would cause things to be too chaotic and random, while pro wrestling is very much, hey, this is what the finish is gonna be.
it's already you're complaining about it being unscripted and then comparing it to the most scripted of all sports.
Do you think that Super Formula fans go, wow, they're turning this into New Japan Pro Wrestling? I'm going to be the guy that's just like, oh man, they're turning NASCAR to All Elite Wrestling.
Oh, yes, Michael McDowell is all in for Daytona 500. I do find it amazing that that's the laziest comparison in the book, and that it's also just so heavily, you're talking about the most heavily scripted sports program out there, and yet Formula One can't string together a hard plan for a sprint race to save its life, because we've been having this conversation on and off for years. Yeah. Regarding either a potential reverse grid race. This was all the rumbling talk last year. When I first saw this come up on the news, I literally joked on Twitter, oh, is that time of year again already? We didn't nobody save this one till June.
That's just it. I mean, look how many years they were trying to mess with qualifying. The one time they did, it sucked so bad they reverted it within 3 rounds.
We don't speak of elimination qualifying round here. It's in the cursed bin alongside Lord Voldemort.
But that's the thing. If you go through Formula One's history, that's the thing that's always changed. Qualifying. Like, every decade, people somehow find a way to get bored with qualifying and come up with a new format. And I think And now we've come up with a qualifying format that actually works.
Yeah, it's like, that's the whole point I was going to make. It was that, okay, you want sprint races. Fine, I can understand why you might think that's an attractive option. And look, on its most pure and basic argument, more racing is probably a good thing. Yeah. My counterpoint to all of this was, you're messing with arguably the best part of a race weekend, which is the current qualifying format. The current qualifying format is awesome. I've always really enjoyed this qualifying format. I like the free splits. I like the drama of guys being on the bubble. Guys often getting their last runs over the line and seeing how the timing tower goes up and down. It's awesome. I genuinely really like this qualifying format, and I don't think there's a particularly good reason to change it. But if your product is great, I could see why someone might want, ooh, more racing. That's what we're really here for. Yeah.
Is the racing product really that great, though?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like the impression that I got is just like, damn, people really don't want to see more Formula One.
Yeah.
It's probably pretty telling.
Because the idea of multiple races in a weekend and sprint and feature races come from championships where the cars are a lot closer. The racing is genuinely more exciting, and you genuinely want to see more racing.
Yeah, what's the point going to be if we get a sprint race that pays off less points? If, let's say it's reverse grid. Mercedes let's make the top 10 reverse grid. Mercedes starts in 9th and 10th. They cut through the field in 5 laps, and the race finishes as per damn usual.
Yeah. And that,
because if the races are long. The midfield guys will just probably sink to the same point that they're at, because the Mercs and Red Bulls are just going to blow through the field.
Yeah. This would be a good idea if the cars were more equal, but they're not.
No.
They're just not.
4 cars in the field are busted, and the bottom 6 are significantly slower than the other midfield. Do the math here, Dre. The midfield 10, I guess you could say. You know, McLaren, Racing Point, Renault, which I say Alpine now technically, Ferrari and AlphaTauri, they're in their own little mini midfield block, and then the
midfield
bottom 3 are
Ferrari.
I know. Well, what a weird sentence. But yeah, overall, I guess, okay. I mean, if it's a free race trial, I mean, sure, why not? But let's see if they actually are able to draft a plan that they can all agree on. Because if there's one thing we joke about on this show relentlessly, it's that Formula One never is able to unanimously agree on anything. So good luck with that, fellas. And I'll await any further developments on that. The other major story that came out of this meeting was the unanimous agreement of an engine freeze. Effective 2022, there will be no more development on the current power units when the new regulations start next season. They're set to start in 2022 for now. Again, that could still change. We already had this brought forward, also pushed back, I should say, a year last year. So again, we don't know what will happen with COVID and whatnot, and that, you know, the domino effect that could come with that. But as it stands, the engine freeze is now official. So development of the power units is off the table. Bad news, Ferrari.
well but, that's also addressed in the the decision to create an engine freeze. Is Formula One intends, and I pay attention to that word, intends to try and balance the engines together via fuel flow adjustments.
And this was Christian Horner that came out and said this, and it was like a gentleman's agreement that they would try and keep the power units close. And my first thought was, good luck with that.
Like, the big problem is that these are, King and I discussed this a couple days ago, these are power units. They are not just an engine with a hybrid system bolted in. They are one holistic system. Mm. And if you take fuel flow away, you take hybrid yield away, you potentially compromise reliability. They're going to need to be very, very careful that in trying to take a little bit of fuel flow off the top to just bring a team back towards every, or a manufacturer back towards everyone else, that they don't accidentally rip the balls off their power unit and cause their ERS system to cut out halfway down the straightaways, like what we saw when Honda couldn't feed their ERS system correctly in 2015, and Ferrari couldn't in 2014. Once the ERS system cuts out, that's a hard 160 horsepower drop, and you just stop accelerating halfway down the straight.
Yeah, and there are, well, we'll get to them very, very briefly. There's going to be a team with, you know, a power unit that doesn't technically have a research and development capability, doesn't have the capabilities of the other manufacturers to develop and see what would our power unit be like if we had, you know, less or more fuel flow, and that could be an issue for them.
Yeah, because obviously the hardware will be frozen, but, you know, unless we get a hard engine map ban, you're always going to have teams pushing the issue on software.
Indeed. And as King alluded to, that team will be Red Bull Racing, because they've announced, I think it was the same day actually, or the day after the freeze was made official, that they have bought the intellectual property on the Honda power unit going forward. So at least until 2025, they are going to have their own branded power units. They're going to have to apparently develop them in-house in Milton Keynes to work on it from there. Basically, and yeah, they've dodged the bullets of having to be supplied by Renault, which was very much on the table last year.
That would have been fun.
I think development is a little bit the wrong word, due to what we just mentioned. They will have until 2025, effectively the same 2021 end of 2021 spec Honda power units. They'll be built and maintained by Red Bull and supplied, obviously, to Red Bull and AlphaTauri, unless AlphaTauri changes their name again. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know the most Red important Bull, Red thing Bull. That they have now? No. You know the most important thing that this team has now?
What?
Not a single excuse for getting this wrong.
If they've got their own engines that they can... Once they have those engines in-house, and they already have a very, very close working relationship with Honda, they're not going to have any packaging surprises, they're not going to be wondering how much power it's going to make, and they're going to have no excuses to build a car around this. Especially if the engines are BOP correctly, and Mercedes and Mugen Honda are now equal. The ball is in your court, Red Bull. It is your job to make a car good enough to compete for the world championship.
And I think that point that you just brought up earlier, the first time we've ever mentioned it in relation to Formula One, BOP. And I think in terms of, yes, the freeze has allowed Honda to, you know, own their own intellectual, like, own the IP to the, yeah. their power units. But that's kind of less important in the grand scheme of things. F1 having any form of BOP to bring the cars closer together is a massive thing for the sport. And I'm surprised it's not being talked about more in terms of people who hate BOP or love BOP.
Yeah, as soon as it actually hits and it affects, let's be honest, it's going to be Mercedes because they have the best power unit.
Yeah.
It's going to go down like a lead balloon with those people. Because as soon as Mercedes loses a race because they happen to not have the engine advantage that they normally have, people are going to cry foul and claim that it's not a real win. I am seeing the Twitter comments now. I already know who's going to tweet it. You were in my DMs a couple weeks ago. You know who you are.
Oh, because yeah, F1 Twitter, that great barometer of F1 discourse. yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, King Lizards, I mean, you're opening Pandora's box here when it comes to Formula One, because you've never really had a hardcore BOP.
You've never had any attempt at balancing the cars. We've had regulation shakeups to try and mix up the order. We were always going to get concessions a la MotoGP. In the new era, but never an attempt to actively peg back and improve certain cars to make them more equal.
Indeed. And that potentially could be a massive deal. We'll have to obviously keep an eye on that going forward. But that is potentially a game changer. And I fear certain factories won't like it if their power units are being curbed or cut off at the pass to try and bring everybody else into play. I mean, Formula One does seem to now actively is thinking, shit, we really do need to try and make the sport a bit more balanced here. Salary caps, cost caps, the hint of BOP, an engine freeze.
I think more balanced is kind of a gentle term. I think Formula One is thinking about making their sport more of a sport.
Yeah. You mean it's not just a development race anymore to sell road cars? What do you mean?
Blasphemous! This goes against the very barriers of Formula One!
The F1 fans, and in and of itself, F1 doesn't know what it wants Formula One to be.
No.
Because you have people screaming on both sides of the aisle that it should be more of a sport, or it should be more of a development war.
Yeah. Road cars, road relevance, etc. It's a nasty tug of war.
I think we should simply enter Japanese K cars. Who wouldn't want to see Max Verstappen wheeling a Honda Beat and its zebra stripe seats?
I vote Fernando Norris in the Daihatsu Copen.
Can they all be shaped like Formula One cars? Man, now I just want to watch more K4 GP. That's what I want.
Go!
Oh, dear. A couple of minor bits of biking news to get out of the way before we move into the season review. I'm going to out of the way real quick. Number one, Yoann Mir teased us all for 12 days about what number he was going to run next year. He's keeping the 36. He's not taking the number one plate. They teased us all on Twitter. Yoann, you're boring. Like, honestly, you've barely got more Twitter followers than John McPhee. Take the damn one plate. You need all the help you can get out here.
Blue ball since 2012.
No one wants the one plate. Like, honestly, riders are incredibly superstitious, but also, I mentioned this on my Substack, that generally speaking, riders care a lot more about their branding these days, and their number is a huge part of that.
If I was sitting in the FIM offices right now, I'd be like, so, guys, when are we changing the international sporting code to mandate that the champion has to use the one?
Now we're talking!
I don't know. We don't give Scott Dixon that much crap for passing on the one every year.
Or I don't know. Like, North American motorsports is a lot different, even though here in the U.S., like, the Supercross champion always runs the one.
It's the same way here.
It's just there's the superstition around it because there's only Valentino who broke that mold, at least in modern times, where he just kept the 46 going.
It's a strange one because Jorge Lorenzo did it the first time in 2011 when he won the world title in 2010. Even had the number one shaped like a JL, so it looked like it was on brand for him. lost the title to Casey Stoner that year, won it again in 2012, and then didn't bring back the number one plate afterwards and stuck with 99. The last person that used the one plate was Casey Stoner back in his final season in 2012. Marquez has had a chance to do it. Didn't take it, wanted to be, and if honestly, if you go in his store, it's 93 everywhere. It's like
the last vestige of it was like a tiny little number one on his rear facing camera, I think in like 2014.
Yeah, but that's it. It's like riders are now synonymous with their number, and it's a big part of their brand now. So I don't expect people to take it. I think Mir missed the trick by not doing
so. I'm not bothered by him not running the one. I'm bothered by him teasing us for 2 weeks that he might run the number one.
That's the annoying part.
You're right. Like, he had my boy Lewis on the MotoGP main account hashtag the decision like it was full LeBron James for a week and a half.
I'm taking my talents back to my regular number.
Yeah, and it was like, you don't tease your audience for a week and a half only to stick with the same number. He thought, well, that means he has to be going to the number one plate, surely. Nope, didn't do it. Stuck with 36. Said that while the idea of running the one was tempting, he said he won two world titles on the 36 and he wanted to stick with the number that brought him good luck. Fun times. Also... I've also shout out to Yamaha. We've actually had now two of the big three unveil their new bikes for 2021. We had Yamaha's a couple days ago. Very, very weird green screening of the whole way through. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's a bit all over the place. Some interesting tidbits were dropped in the middle of that, like Fabio Quartararo now has hired a sports psychologist, which I thought was interesting after his collapse last season.
How much are we going to bet that in preseason testing, we're going to hear from all the Yamaha riders and team members of how fantastic this bike is, only for it to win in the opening two or three rounds, fall off, and then nobody can stop bitching about the bike for the rest of the year?
I got that about even money, champ.
That will probably happen.
They're going for like a four-year streak on this.
They also revealed they've only got three top spec Yamahas between them and their satellite Petronas team. And guess which one's missed out again? That's right, the one who was the best on those bikes last season, Frankie Morbidelli. So Valentino Rossi gets the 2021 spec Yamaha, as does the two factory runners. Frankie Morbidelli, who let's not forget was championship runner-up last year, doesn't get one. I just think that's funny, personally.
Dre, do you know if he's on the 2020 or 2019 spec M1?
I'm not sure yet. Apparently, they're going to be testing parts when they roll up in Qatar in about a month's time.
Weird way to boost Franco Morbidelli's rider value by just having him constantly overachieve in year-old equipment.
Yeah,
but year-old equipment that the Yamaha factory team can't stop whining about. Someone gets on it as used equipment and they go and beat the factory.
Yeah, it's a strange one because Frankie, towards the end of last year, insisted to stick with the 2019 chassis and frame because he liked it so much. He didn't want the 2020 frames that his peers were running. He was like, no, I'm good on this one. And he won three races on it. So who am I to argue with the man? So I thought that was quite funny as well. So yeah, I think Honda's presentation is next.
Oh, no, we need to talk about the other one that happened. King.
What?
They're the same color as your shirt.
Oh,
and the most orange bike ever produced. Factory and Tech 3 KTM unveiled their bikes.
Yeah, I was like, so King, what did you make of the all-orange Tech 3 lineup? It was extremely orange.
Yeah.
As orange as your jumper.
The Tech 3 looks like what the factory bike should look like.
I know!
Yeah, it looks like the livery they run in Supercross, where it's just, there isn't a livery, it's just orange.
Yep.
It's just orange, like... I don't like how with the factory team you get this enormous matte dark blue typical Red Bull slab on the side of it, like you get with their racing drivers' helmets in Formula One. It's like just like poof, Red Bull, and it's like, yep, just in case you didn't know who sponsored this team or anything. But KTM got the full orange gun up going on there. A bit concerned they have a lack of sponsors on the second bike, but besides that, very pretty, if I do say
KTM
so myself.
Has enough
Orange
money.
Arrows F1 team thinks that the KTM bikes of 2021
indeed.
Too orange. And yeah, Honda's is on February 22nd. That livery is the safest bet in the world because there is no chance in hell that they're changing it.
Nope.
I thought they were personally going to bring back the Austin Powers one for the end of 2003.
I just want them to bring back the dark Repsol colors. Also, in another bit of news, Mark Marquez passed his most recent checkup. The bone is healing well.
Yay!
The entire rest of the MotoGP grid. Oh god, oh fuck.
Keep back.
It's working. So yeah, he can now basically train on an actual motorcycle and not just get. Obviously, he's got work to do getting the strength back in his right arm. Because if you see pictures of him, his right arm is significantly smaller than his left one in terms of thickness.
It's the opposite of all the jokes we've seen in Family Guy.
Very much so. So they'll be keeping an eye on that. Also, it's the man's birthday today. 28 years old. It's happy birthday, Mark Marquez. It's a terrifying thought that man's only 28 years old. What have we done with our lives?
It's a terrifying thought that he's already 28 years old.
Man was a baby when he came into the sport.
Yeah, remember they changed the rules because he was under the 21-year-old minimum age limit to ride that bike. But they had to change the rules because he was technically Moto2 champ at 19. So they had to change the rules to say, hey, if you won the Moto2 title, we can promote you up now regardless of age. They had to do the same thing with Quartararo in Moto3 because that had a 16-year-old age limit and Quartararo was 15 when he won the junior world title. Let's just say Dorn has a great knack of bending their own rules to suit their needs. It's very, very useful indeed. But happy birthday, yo, Mark. And
I cannot wait for Mark Marquez to show up in FP1 just popping out like John Cena at the Royal Rumble at the Garden in 08, 4 months removed from having pectoral torn off the bone.
That'll be
John Cena.
Yeah, just play the Stone Cold theme in the background as he comes out and it's like, yeah, Marquez is coming out to raise hell. After this quick break, we'll be back and we'll be talking Formula E's 2021 season preview.
For the purposes of bookkeeping, this is the first official FIA Formula E World Championship that we'll have in the year 2021. But the talent of the series and the manufacturer involvement, at least the opinion of this Motorsport 101 co-host, should have really justified its status as a top-level championship, a world championship many years before. Still, we're here now, and in the midst of the never-ending coronavirus outbreak, the only thing that's for sure about the Formula E calendar in 2021 is that nothing's for sure. Oh, by the time you hear this, we'll be racing in the streets of Riyadh for the doubleheader Daria E Prix on the 26th and 27th of February. And what we also know is that the first part of the calendar thereafter is as follows. Rome on the 10th of April, the racing debut at the Circuit Ricardo Tormo Valencia follows that just 2 weeks later. We will have a Monaco E-Prix on the 8th of May, by all accounts, as the Principality is going to build the racetrack, just in the news today. Marrakesh in Morocco, always a favorite, follows on the 22nd of May. And then finally, the delayed Santiago E-Prix in Chile on the 5th and 6th of June, another doubleheader. And then after that, the second part of the calendar, King? Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows what it'll look like?
Yeah, due to the times we live in, it is, frankly, an unknown.
Yeah, all of this is still very much up in the air. Looks like Saudi Arabia is a definite. Beyond that, fingers crossed. Hopefully. That is a provisional schedule. Emphasis on provisional. King, I know you wanted to mention the homologation status going in as well.
Yes, so far, basically, teams were given the option to homologate their new powertrains, which they would use for the rest of the Gen 2 period, either at the start of this year or sometime later on this year. All but three teams elected to choose to change over at the start of the year. All but Dragon, Nissan, and Tachita. And it's becoming fairly clear that all these teams will do the move over for the Romy Prix, whatever that may be, even though it seems like Rome seems to be definitely going to happen, but, you know, nothing certain nowadays.
Yeah.
Indeed. So Rome seems to be one of the critical points of the season. Again, as King pointed out, very interesting that it's the first and second team in last year's championship, and then the team second from last. Bit of a bizarre one, that, but we'll roll with it. Now, we'll talk a little bit about this team by team. We're going to go in reverse championship order from last year, because that's way more fun. Which unfortunately means you've got to kind of get Neo 333 out of the way. Where do we start with the Neo team here? They've been the little team who's tried. They didn't score a single point last season, despite having a car in 11th, 30 doors.
Yeah. It's rough out here.
It is rough out here, but testing looked a bit more promising. Oliver Turvey was in the top 10. We would say that Valencia was completely unrepresentative until they changed the provisional calendar and now we're actually going to race around it. So it's a little bit more relevant, I guess.
I hope that this is a sign. I mean, because it looks like Neo 333 is out of the worst of it. And regarding their driver lineup, Oliver Turvey Oliver Turvey needs to go in for, like, spinal fusion surgery with how worn his back is from putting that entire team on it for the last handful of years.
Such a loyal servant.
And I'll say this about Tom Blomqvist. I know he's not had many representative Formula E appearances. He only has a single point scoring finish, and that was in a partial season with Andretti a few years ago, but... I generally get the impression that he's much better than his results show. I mean, Christmas, he was between Ocon and Verstappen in that year in European F3 in 2014. Yeah. On driving talent alone, this should be a much better team. I just can't see them breaking out of the basement just yet.
Yeah, it's going to be a year where we're going to hear things from Neo 333 along the lines of that long said phrase out of Philadelphia, trust the process.
Oh, God.
Oh, no. Someone tell that to Joel Embiid and see if he doesn't smack the taste out of your mouth right now. It's like, yeah, I'm going to put up 35 and lose by 20. It's the Neo way. But yeah, I mean, as RJ alluded to, on the driver lineup is a lot better on paper than what the team is pound for pound in the sport right now. But there's been no indication they're going to lift themselves out of the doldrums just yet. That's the impression that I get, at least.
Yeah, gut feeling they're probably going to be fighting for 11th with the next team.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about that next team? Because that next team is Dragon, the most popular team in the field.
Yes, Geox Dragon, who this year have Nico Müller and Sergio Sette Câmara.
Ooh. Again, it's another case of the driving talent alone should indicate this is a competitive team. Dragon Racing just haven't been that since Jerome D'Ambrosio up and left them.
Indeed. They've never been quite the same since then, and they've been down the bottom for a little while. There's been a lot of calls to question about how that team has operated, what it's done with driver lineups.
Guys, you remember when they were second in the team's championship in the inaugural year?
That seems like a long gaping chasm ago.
like recall back to the good old days of season one, where the team that was now Neo 333 were the team champions, and Dragon were second in the championship. Now they're both on the bottom.
With Oriel Servia driving for Dragon and Charles Peak in the rotation at what was now Neo 333. This is wild. I think it's hard to say. I mean, you can't get much worse than they did last year, but I don't feel... Yeah, I can't. The only thing that has me optimistic is how Sette Câmara fares in his first full season.
it gets that
yeah,
far.
Yeah, it's the thing about these bottom two teams is that it sure as hell isn't the driving talent in the seats that are the problem.
No. I was going to say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is it that you think the two drivers, Nico Müller and Sergio Sete Câmara, are in those seats right now, are the two drivers that finished the year?
Don't know about that, Chief.
Not
I. I mean, Christ, they Brendan Hartley was just like, I'm good before we even got to the Berlin Setstuple.
Yeah, I don't want that. I'm going to go win some Le Mans races. Fuck
Neil Yanni up and left after one bad weekend in Hong Kong.
Oh, man.
And we thought that was as bad as it was going to get for its Formula E tenure. Unfortunately, not.
So, King, what's your gut feeling? Still in the fight for the temp spot here?
Gut feeling, I think Dragon are going to finish last, and Neo will be 11th.
Damn.
So you think Dragon goes all the way to the bottom?
Yes.
Oh, boy. Okay.
I started from the bottom and was somehow be able to get even lower.
I'd hope they pick up at least some points to offset that. I don't think any team's going to go scoreless, but that's not out of the realm of question.
Yeah, Neo went scoreless last year.
To the 9 spot from last year, our friends at Rocket Venturi Racing. We have Todoro Mortara, and now rookie making his debut in the series, Norman Nato is coming in as well in the 71 car.
Ado Mortara, the other Swiss DTM driver in the field.
We're all one big family here. And again, like they were ninth overall last year. Obviously, significantly better than the bottom two that we've seen. They were 44 points last year in the points on quite a few occasions, but never troubling the thick end of the leaderboard. Again, it's another Mortara is genuinely really really quick when he's got the right car underneath him. The problem is that they don't seem to have the right car underneath them very often. That's the impression that I get. And, you know.
They had one the year before last. The problem is now that last year Mortara scored, all but three of the team's points because I'm not saying Felipe Massa was a bit over the hill last season, but my man's was cooked.
Cooked.
Norman Nato was never a serious Formula One prospect when he was racing in Formula Two. But I'll say this, he's a much better choice for Formula E than I think people give him credit for. I mean, he's been solid in endurance racing ever since he stepped in there.
Yeah, he drove for Rebellion the last couple of years and was...
Yeah, won a couple of rounds. Finished second overall last year.
Yeah, against some quality co-drivers, he was far from embarrassing himself. He did a good job.
Yeah,
I don't expect him to lead the team, but I expect him to be a bit more productive than Moss was last season.
Yeah,
I still expect Mortara to breathe the stir that stirs this the straw that stirs the drink. I can talk.
Yeah, it's that weird situation where Formula E requires a lot of different skill sets from a lot of different styles of racing to be good in Formula E. But usually the number one determining factor on whether a rookie will be good or not in Formula E is how much they're willing to learn and adapt to Formula E's unique style of racing.
So not causing a lap one wreck, basically.
Yeah.
Or causing a lap one wreck and being or causing it and being the one who benefits from it. Both
Indeed.
Can apply.
I mean, any major movement out of them, do you reckon, King? Or are they going to be in that lower end of the midfield? Because the next team we're talking about was very close to them last year as well. Friends from India.
Yeah, I think they're going to be in the same spot. Formerly his competitive order is starting to somewhat solidify. And unfortunately, Venturi in their position, somewhat being a Mercedes B team, are kind of going to be, midfield at best.
As Finley points out, though, will vice captain Jerome D'Ambrosio be a little lift to this team, I wonder?
Oh, I'd love to see it.
The Grand Tour guest, Jerome D'Ambrosio.
Multiple time Francois Chevert lookalike champion, Jerome D'Ambrosio.
As you do. So, we'll have to wait and see how Venturi holds up on that one. Again, one very, very good driver in Mortara there on his day, but I think they could be battling the guys that we're going to talk about next, and that's our friends at Mahindra. Mahindra Racing. It's, as we have to call them now, Team Alex for this year. It's the Alex Power Hour with Alex Sims in the 29 car and then Alex Lynn back in the series in the 94 car. I miss when Sims was in a BMW. Those were fun times. Drove hard, had enough, went viral with memes because it was a creative use of umbrellas and taking it easy, but generally speaking was very good. Like, what do we make of Mahindra here in this situation? Because we know they can punch above their weight. We saw it with Pascal Wehrlein not too long ago. But
we saw that, but again, without Pascal late in last year, things were rough over at Mahindra. Yeah. They seemed to really be lost without Pascal leading the charge.
I'll say that Lynn's probably a better driver. And to his credit, he did rattle off three straight point scoring finishes at the Berlin Sets Topple to end the year.
I don't think the problem so much is the drivers they have. It's, can the team now build around what is effectively a very new lineup?
And from certain information that, in terms of, you know, their powertrain was lacking and there was a lot of room for improvement, that it's not all just down on the drivers. Like, Pascal definitely made up the difference in a lot of areas.
He hit the stage with that team where he got another opportunity, which we'll talk about in a minute, and he bailed as soon as he could.
Yeah. I'm out!
Yeah, and on that note, I think it's kind of bullshit that Mahindra are keeping his F1 number hostage, but that's besides the point. I don't think that has any bearing in their competitive form. Yeah, Mahindra's been on a bit of a steady decline. Third, fourth, sixth, and then ninth last year, and it's only going to get more competitive. I would like to see them make an uptick in form. Sims is an E-Prix winner. He's certainly good enough.
Yeah, Sims is a proven quantity. So is Lynn.
Yeah, like, I could see them improving on last year, but not by much.
It could be another fight for a separate fight for ninth, because again, there's a big step up in points when we get to the next team compared to last year. If we want to use that as a yardstick, certainly. I mean, them and Ventura are pretty close. Then it's quite a jump up to the next team, and there is a lot of excitement in the air about this team, especially on the bottom right corner of our Discord window. It's the Tag Heuer Porsche team, when we saw testing go now, again, not really representative, but that didn't stop a certain someone in here being quite giddy with excitement. Again,
the thing is, I wasn't. It was information from another member of our Discord.
He's lying.
New driver, we just mentioned him, Pascal Wehrlein, takes over Johnny's seat alongside André Lotterer.
Yeah, and we're not even halfway through the teams yet. But due to Formula E's nature, I could easily say that anyone from this point onwards is a championship contender.
Yeah, I was about to say, this is win now mode for Porsche. This is year two, and they're pretty much, of all the German manufacturers other than Mercedes, one of the only ones that is committed to this series long term. We'll get to that in a few teams in a second. They have Lotterer, who should have been, has multiple podiums in this series by now, is a proven quantity, probably should have won an E-Prix at some point down the road, and now you don't have an excuse to say, well, the other car's not under-delivering, because now Pascal Wehrlein's on the team now.
Yeah, they've last year was races. Last year was very much a tale of really three seasons, because Johnny was nowhere. Yeah. He was just nowhere all year. And then Lotterer was either fighting for wins, crashed out, or midfield.
Not the three seasons you really want to go through if you're going to be a driver in a series
this. Yeah, in one
year. There's
no
real good option here.
Yeah, we know the car is good. We know both drivers are good. I want to see them win some races this year.
Yeah.
And King, I know you mentioned people who were there at testing. It was like months ago, because the world we live in right now, said that the Porsche was, what was the quote you said? A weapon?
Yeah, a weapon. Like,
yeah.
It's usually, you know, people don't read the testing times that much in other championships, but in Formula E, when you're fast in testing and people notice it, you're generally going to be fast in the year. Because last year, the champions of the preseason were BMW, and while
I mean, they were fast. They won two of the first three, yeah. But the problem was
they were fast, and then they spent half the year in the wall. And I'm not expecting championship out of them, but I am expecting consistent podiums, a couple wins has to be the goal this year for Porsche.
I'm thinking top three in the team's championship at minimum.
Yeah, that has to be the goal.
Yeah, given who we're talking about and given who people we trust in this Discord with Formula E, it seems like top three would be a reasonable aim for this team. It would be a big improvement where they were last year when they were eighth. But the hype is real in the camp. We've seen it out on track. It certainly passes the eye test in terms of seeing what they can do on a track. And again, we do race around Valencia this year now, so that's bound to be interesting, to say the least. It's a hell of a team. You mentioned Lotterer is, I think, a bit better than his results show, and Pascal Wehrlein is more than capable of winning races with the right setup underneath him. It's a very exciting team.
If he was scraping podiums in a Mahindra that is generally considered pretty awful behind the scenes...
He was a fingertip away from winning Mexico City, goddammit!
Then I'm expecting great things out of Pascal this year.
Indeed. Yeah, looking forward to that indeed. Next down the line is our friends at Panasonic Jaguar Racing. And we have our friend and yours, Mr. Free to Play, Mitch Evans in the number 20 car.
What's this wee shit? What's this wee shit? I haven't forgotten Mexico last year.
You're still salty about this, I see.
I will never not be.
I will never log off, etc., etc. Free to play, Mitch Brá in the number 20 seat, but he's got a new teammate, and it's one that I don't think at one point we'd ever see in different colours, but here we are in the number 10 car. The bird is indeed the word. Sam Bird in representing Jaguar Racing in one of the high-profile moves amongst the grid.
I'd say that's the high-profile move of the off-season. Yeah. Sam Bird has been with Virgin Racing his entire Formula E tenure.
Yeah, he said this was, I think, the right time in his career for a fresh start. And he's gone over to Jaguar. And, I mean, King, it's a pretty good team. We know this team's got a lot of upside, certainly.
More than capable of winning this thing, mainly due to what everyone remembers last year. Heading into Berlin, Mitch Evans seemed like he was the favorite to win the championship, and then everything collapsed.
Yeah, just by virtue of consistency, just reeling off good results.
Yeah, and they got to Berlin, and it all just dried up. The top end
Antonio Felix
da
Costa dropped not just the piano, but the whole ensemble on the field.
It just didn't happen for him in the second half of the year. As I call it, the Tempelhof Knights mini season, as we like to call it on here.
We love our Tempelhof Knights.
It's a great team. Like, there is no reason why. The more I look at it now, the more I think King is right. The top seven or eight really do genuinely have a shot here. And again, we've seen Jaguar win races, compete on the highest level consistently. There's no reason why this team can't win the championship. They've got a good car, a good powertrain, and two pretty damn good drivers that we know can win. Like,
Sam Bird's won a race every season.
Yeah.
The problem is the last couple of years he's just fallen away from championship contention, which is strange to think about, because he's the most successful driver that has not won a title in the young history of Formula E.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. They can win races. They can put together good results. They can't put a season together. At least they haven't so far. And it's time for them to put a season together.
Indeed. Look, this is a team that should not be seventh on paper. Like, they are way better than that. And I think you watch them and you think, that's the seventh best team? How does that work? King, I don't know how you feel about it, but they, for me, they tick just about every box.
Yeah, they do tick about every box. Like, gut feeling, I don't think Evans is going to be as good as he was last year, but Bird and a Jag, I'm scared.
Yeah, Bird is a proven quantity. We know what he can do, and he's got a fresh crew around him. He's got a solid car. Let's see what he can do this year. That's the thing. Going into this year, Sam Bird has people that he has something to prove.
This is the hottest lineup of the 2013 GP3 series, all in one team. GP2 series, I'm sorry. I apologize for putting Sam Bird down in GP3.
Oh, dear. We still miss the days of Catalunya and Sam Bird corner. Good times. Living up again, let's take a look at Audi. Audi sporting what will be their final season in Formula E.
Yeah, what do we think about this? Because last year, we thought Audi was just... We thought they were bad. We thought they were awful last year. And then they plugged Rene Rast in during Tempelhof Nights. And he was instantly fighting for podiums.
Yeah, big shot in the arm for Audi right at the end of last year when Rast came in and was immediately fighting for podiums.
Yeah, was immediately outperforming Lucas Degrassi. Day one.
And clearly, all the talk, like, all the car, like... With Degrassi now, I'm like, oh man, I wish this car performed better. Nah, fam.
No, that's gone. That's dead.
we don't speak of that no more around here. Damn it. And yeah, no surprise, they've retained that lineup. Lucas Degrassi in the number 11 car, Rene Rast in the 33. Again, like, we all know Audi has the pedigree to be able to do this, but they've
been...
An
all-new powertrain this year as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, is this going to be a case of them going out on a bang?
Yes,
and
because...
hopefully a metaphorical one rather than a literal one?
While Audi's factory team is leaving, they'll still be providing their powertrain to Virgin. So, they still have a reason to develop this powertrain. Like, just because they're leaving doesn't mean...
Yeah,
they're gonna
the only
stop
thing that
caring.
Ends is the factory involvement.
Yep.
Mm.
And,
And
yeah, Rene Rast, for all my personal beef with him over the Tempelhof Nights last year, he is box office.
Yeah.
He's one of the best drivers in the world. He proves it every time he steps into damn well anything he gets
just
into.
Just about anything.
There's no reason why Rene Rast can't be easy top five or higher in the championship this year.
I think Rene Rast is going to solidify his legacy as Audi's Grim Reaper. Last year, he won DTM, and then Audi left. After, you know, Audi announced they're leaving. Rene Rast wins the title.
God, we haven't had an Audi Grim Reaper since the heyday of, like, the big banger diesel LMPs.
Yes, and now Rene Rast has come to Formula E to take Audi away with the trophy.
Where's his scythe? Like,
it's still plunged into the left front corner of Andre Lotterer's Porsche.
I still feel iffy about the circumstance of which Daniel App was asked to leave the team. But Rene Rast is a serious good driver to plug in his place. And this is the first time that there has been a genuine struggle for power and dominance within Audi Sport App Schaeffler. Because Lucas Degrassi, well, he prides himself on being Formula E's very first test driver. He prides himself on being the franchise. And for all the talk about his struggles, he was still sits in the championship and regularly scoring top tens. And you gotta feel like this is kind of his last roll of the dice to see, is he gonna come back into championship contention? Or are we starting to see the decline of the franchise of Formula E?
I think this franchise is gonna end up like the Sanchez.
Oh!
Someone who's listening, enshrine that in the quotes channel of our supporters club.
Agreed.
I tend to agree with King. I think Rast has his number. I really do.
Really?
Yeah.
So is that going right to be one of our gate. Bold? Is that going to be one of our M101 bold predictions for the motorsport season? Rast beats Degrassi head to head.
I don't think it's that bold, to be honest.
I know. No, I don't think it's that bold either.
We think Lucas is on the other side of the hill that bad.
Yep.
Okay.
It's gonna be like, hey Lucas, come on, we're heading to LMDH.
and it's you talk about that like it's a farm upstate. Jesus fucking Christ!
It sounded like he was taking Lucas behind the barn. I was just like, it's Jesus King.
Yeah,
it's time to be a plastic platinum in GT4 competition, buddy.
No, yeah, and I look back to the last time I really remember them in the Audi camp together in the same series was at Le Mans 2015, and as Audi's challenge began to fall apart in the later hours, it was Rast in the number 9 Audi who was really the last man standing.
Mm. Look,
so,
you don't need any convincing from us. Like, René Rast is genuinely one of the pound-for-pound best racing drivers on the planet. So,
yeah, we've been saying
every year. Wait, everyone stop. Everyone stop. Our resident Audi supporter in the Discord, Sasha. Has posted, and this needs to go in the quotes channel too, Lucas, future is an attitude, and you're tired.
Beautiful. That's beautifully done. Well done, Sasha. Oh. You just hit the quote section. Congratulations, sir. Beautifully done. Let's move up a little bit further, shall we? Into last year's top five. And BMW Andretti Autosport, I should say.
Another team that's leaving. Goodbye.
Yeah, the last season with BMW as a factory supplier in the sport.
Oh, how much promise last year started with, and oh, how it fell the fuck apart.
Oh, yes, ended up in the bin very quickly. The team was shit hot to start the year, won 2 of the first 3, and now only win 1 other race for the rest of the year. It was rough, but one of their drivers, I am certainly convinced, I think has got every chance of being a contender for the championship, a guy that is genuinely excellent, Maxi Günther in the 28 car.
Maxi Günther's legit, y'all.
Oh, he's very, very, very good.
He dragged Dragon Racing to top fives that they had no business scoring.
No.
And he took 2 wins in a season that was otherwise, you know, it was either win or bust for Maxi Günther in 2019-20. He's got to string together some consistency. I'm confident that he will. I'm looking at Jake Dennis. I'm thinking that's a shrewd pick.
Yeah.
Jake Dennis ain't no scrub. Pick.
Yeah.
This team, if they iron out the mistakes of last year, and they were many, and they came quick and fast.
They're rich and plentiful.
Yeah, they were rich and plentiful. If they can iron out the mistakes, they could conceivably destroy the field this season.
I want to bring up something here. That Jake Dennis in 2015 was only bested in the championship by Felix Rosenqvist and Antonio Giovinazzi. He finished ahead of Leclerc, he finished ahead of Stroll, he finished ahead of Russell and Albon, and Maxi Gunther's there too. Oh, and some guy named Ferrucci, but who cares?
Fuck that guy. look, Mans is good. He is a proven quantity. We know he's good behind the wheel of a race car.
Absolutely.
It's been kind of a reoccurring theme throughout this whole preview is the depth of field just purely on the driver side is phenomenal this year in Formula E.
Like,
I don't agree with the assertion that like Formula E drivers are just saying they enjoy it for the money. I think they genuinely enjoy racing.
I think that's a narrative created by the, it's just an insert series here, reject series. No, this is a series that on its own merits has a superb driver lineup.
Yeah. Like, we've had complimentary things to say about almost every driver on this roster so far. And, like, Jake Dennis is a very shrewd bit of a business for BMW to bring in the second car. We know it was a little bit in the past, but we know he has beaten in similar machinery some of the very best racing drivers in the world that we look at now half a decade later.
Like Christmas after spending a whole year in the Aston Martin BMW DTM program.
God, he like led that program. That program was so irrelevant, I forgot he was involved.
Yeah, I was oh, here's our R Motorsport Astons with Jake Dennis and Ferdinand Habsburg.
And Paul DiResta.
sexy.
and then Audi and BMW said, hold our Hefeweizen.
Yeah. I mean, King, what do you make of BMW's chances here? Again, all round very, very strong on paper, I think.
Very strong lineup, I think they're just going to spend the whole year thinking about what's next, because Andretti don't want to leave. Like, BMW may be leaving, but Andretti don't want to leave. What's going to happen with the drivers? Like, is Jake Dennis going to... Like, is Gunther tied to BMW? Is he leaving after this is over? Or is he going to stay with any Andretti project after this?
It feels like that's their problem this year, is that all the ingredients that are there are very, very good. But the shadow of 2022 season looms very large over this team.
Yeah,
yeah, and if I'm Andretti, I do not want to let a guy as talented as Max Gunther potentially walk. That is an excellent number one guy in your scene.
Not without a damn good replacement already in the pipeline. I'll say that much.
They're a very, very good team, and again, absolutely ones to look out for as BMW says goodbye. Speaking of veteran presences, Envision Virgin Racing.
Harley Davidson Virgin Racing.
you stop.
Oh my. And again, another great lineup here. We've got Robin Frins in the number four car. Another excellent, you know, race winning level driver at the front of the field. And
RJ, you're looking very smug over there, RJ.
Mr. Japanese Motorsport on the top right corner looking very smug because he got the rookie in there, but it's quite a good one in the 37 car, Nick Cassidy, ladies and gentlemen. And
this is going to be the most fun team of the series. Robin Frins is awesome. Nick Cassidy is going to be rookie of the year.
Box office.
Both these guys are box office.
Like, they're not...
They just got to have a consistent season. That's all I'm asking.
Yeah, there are not many people... Like, there are not many people in motorsport who I can, you know, say, yeah, they could fill Sam Bird's shoes at Virgin, but Nick Cassidy is definitely one of those dudes.
Everything over the last couple of years, everything Nick Cassidy touches turns to gold. He is competitive in anything you plug him into.
Indeed, one of the most versatile, all-round, incredibly quick talents in motorsport.
Robin Frins is no scrub either. I mean, I know last year was kind of a down year, though, because he took a dip, didn't win a race after winning two last season. I think he'll get that sorted. But yeah, Frins has proven he's been good in junior formula. He's been excellent in junior formula. Hell, Robin Frins was what Max Verstappen was hyped up to be before Max Verstappen even stepped out of go-karts.
Yeah.
And then he's been great in GT cars. He's been great in DTM. He's been a race winner in Formula E.
Yeah.
Like, Frins has been excellent in Formula E from, like, year two of this series. He's always been in and around that mix. Like, he's from pretty much the start of his time in the series, he's been outstanding. So... Again, it's an incredible team, especially like driver lineup on paper. We know Virgin is always in or around the winner's circle, and again, they're always good for a couple of wins a year. Is this the year they finally put it all together? I don't know.
It's going to be tough.
Another thing as well is they are the other team, and going forward, they will be potentially the replacement for the factory. They're the other team getting the new in-house Audi powertrain for this year.
Yeah,
it's gonna be good.
They have all the cards stacked in their favor.
Yeah, they're another team with all the parts. They have all the parts to win a championship, but we gotta put rubber to pavement before we really know how good they are.
Yeah,
indeed. Again, incredibly strong team on paper. Again, we're going to keep repeating ourselves down the line because next up, Mercedes. Hello. Here comes the hammer because it's the Mercedes team. And what was our closing image at the end of last season? Yeah, it was a Stoffel season, as King likes to say. It's an incredible team. Number five, Stoffel Van Dorn. And then the 17 car, 2019 Formula 2 champion Nick de Vries. I mean, come on. Do I even need to explain how this team is great?
Great team. Stoffel Vandoorne, anything he touches throughout his whole career turns to gold, unless it turns papaya orange and shit.
Yeah, pretty much.
But I think he's a lot happier with a car that is capable of scoring points in the second half of the year.
I think it's just happier to have, like, a PlayStation 5 for a change. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
I think he would have preferred the real thing at the end of last year. Sorry, Stoffel. Yeah. And Nick de Vries.
Last year's Rookie of the Year.
Last year's Rookie of the Year, but Stoffel pretty comprehensively dominated him all year.
Yeah,
I think that's to be expected, because being a rookie in Formula E is very, 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 very hard.
Even then, it was only Stoffel's second season.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like this is another championship or bust kind of team that I'm looking at.
Yeah, they're top definitely...
Top three minimum.
I mean, it's Mercedes. It's the Mercedes-Benz mantra. It's always win now. Though, it's clear that if they do win now, it's going to be Stoffel. Like, de Vries is, unless things drastically change, de Vries is somewhat the number two. Like, he his number might be 17, but he's certainly no 77. He's going to be a very strong number two.
Oh my god.
12?
12.
You think Nick de Vries remembers all those years in the McLaren Academy with Stoffel right up above him in the hierarchy for all those years, to the point that he never got a Formula One ride himself?
Yeah, that must have sucked. It's easy to forget that while it was close at the end of the season, we are talking about Stoffel Vandoorne, last year's championship runner-up.
Yeah.
Because right up at the end, Mercedes ran on a very, very good string of results.
Yeah, and it's easy to forget that, because it was a bloodbath in the fight for second towards the end of last season. Da Costa was down the road, like, three races
it was picking to see who went to Antonio Felix Da Costa's guillotine.
Yeah. And yeah, Stoffel did come out on top in that bloodbath last year in a highly competitive situation where literally one of half the field could have ended up in second going into those final two races in Tempelhof. So Stoffel, proven clutch guy. We all know how great a racing driver he is. We all know how McLaren did him dirty. You don't need me to tell you that on this show. You know, Nick de Vries, solid pair of hands in the second car. Merckx, big name reputation, big name car. We know it can win pretty much at will. They're going to want a championship. Simple as that. Moving along, we have last year's championship runners up, and always a solid pair of hands at the worst of times. Nissan E-Dams, and all reliable, as SpongeBob might say in the cartoon. In number 23, Sebastian Buemi. We all know how good he is.
Sebastian Buemi, eternal.
Eternal. He's here forever. He will bring together all of Japanese motorsport in one tight, convenient, politically sound package. And the number 22 car next to him, Oliver Rowland, who was pretty damn good last year, was in that bloodbath for second in the championship. Again, he was fifth. It's not fair.
For most of the year last year, you would have never guessed that Nissan would end up second. But
right
at the end, they got their shit together. And, you know, ever since the inception of Formula E, this team in its many guises is a perennial threat.
Yeah. And considering last year Nissan E-Dams, they'll let you know 1,000 times over that, hey, the powertrain setup we wanted to run this season got banned, and we had to throw together something in an emergency, and despite that, they finished second in the championship. Now they had an entire offseason to prepare for this. I'm slightly worried about how good they're going to be.
Look, we have zero question marks over their drivers. Rowland was excellent. Buemi is maybe pound for pound the best driver in the series.
There's certainly an argument you can make there. When Buemi was at his peak, in like the first handful of seasons, we were talking about this dude is making this series boring. That's how good he was.
Yeah, and he, of
and
course,
that's how
he's
good he
off.
Can still be. I mean, Christmas, he only turns 33 this season.
Yep. Keep in mind, he's also on a hat trick of Le Mans 24-hour victories alongside his co-driver in the number 8 Toyota.
Decent driver. Decent.
Yeah, like, Nissan E-Dams are going to be that old house on the hill. It was there before you. They're going to be there long after you're gone.
Yeah.
Unflappable. Like, as Thanos would say, inevitable.
and all this despite there. All the unrest at the Nissan Renault Mitsubishi Alliance.
Carlos Ghosn
like
do
crimes.
They couldn't even be broken by Carlos Ghosn do crimes.
Yep. No. Unflappable. They're just the most the consummate professionals. They are always there. They can win any given race on paper if they get their shit in line. They are probably...
when they have a consistent car and a consistent team and they can minimize mistakes, they work harder and more in depth at this game than anyone else.
Yeah, they're incredibly... Look, if you're beating E-Dams over a season, you're probably
you're doing things right.
You're either A, a very good team, or B, you've probably just won the championship. Just like the last team on the list that did so last year, and pretty much slaughtered the field in a bloodbath, because Antonio Felix da Costa was that dude. What guy? That guy last year.
Yeah,
the rulers.
The rulers of Tempelhof. DS to Cheetah.
Yes. DS to Cheetah, you know the drill. It's an unchanged lineup. Number 13, Antonio Felix da Costa and his best friend, and or should I say best frenemy, number 25, Jeff. Jean-Eric Vergne in the 25 car, and is there any movement on their position as favourites going into this? Because we all know this team is a monster.
Well, I think it goes to when it came to light that Antonio Felix da Costa was going to do an IndyCar test with Rahal Letterman Lanigan, people questioned if he was going to leave the series. He told people no. He wanted to stay in Formula E. He wanted to do in Formula E what Lewis Hamilton did in F1, which...
That's a hell of a statement! Man!
That is... pretty much akin to LeBron James going out on the floor of American Airlines Arena and saying, not one, not two, not three.
Small asterisk next to DS to Cheetah is that they didn't run their new powertrain in testing.
Yep.
They're saving it for a rainy day. And they were still pretty fast.
Yeah. Look, Jeff is one of the best drivers this series ever had. Yeah, an early adopter. We all know what he's capable of. Da Costa absolutely ran the field over last year.
Yeah. His solution to the championship was, I'm going to keep winning until the championship is over.
These guys have both been here since season one. For Da Costa, it was kind of a more gradual climb at the top because he spent some time in some bad teams.
Yeah.
Like before Andretti got that BMW deal, when Team Aguri was still a thing, and he actually won a race with them. Vergne, it was just like he always had that potential and then he finally put it together and then he became elite.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, this was back in the day when Aguri was better at giving away caps than they were at actually being good in Formula E.
I've got one of those caps.
Me too! Who hasn't got one of those caps? It's very... Oh, poor Cam. See, you didn't beg hard enough on Twitter.
Penalty. But unnecessary horniness.
I think the only... 15 yards. I think the thing that I worry about is... We know Da Costa and Vergne are very competitive on the surface. Do we think that their partnership is going to get more toxic? Do we think that there's going to be a swing of the power? Do you think Vergne is going to have a resurgence of form?
I think it's going to depend on how potentially the new powertrain suits each driver. Because last year, DaCosta ended up so far ahead of Vern late in the season that they couldn't have on-track beef. And I rate Jeff very, very highly as a driver. It feels like their relationship near the end of last year was going from early 2014 Mercedes F1 to post-Monaco Mercedes F1.
I was going to say, it was like, I looked at it like they were frenemies towards the end of last year. It's like, I know Jev was very happy for Antonio when he actually won the championship. He was like, come here, old boy, and next thing you know that he's jumping in each other's arms. And I was like, you can tell that Jev was not exactly best pleased that he'd been dethroned. It's like he had the steel chair by his side ready to go, and he didn't quite swing it.
It's like when Lorenzo was winning titles.
It's like when Marquez won his first couple titles and Rossi wasn't in the hunt. And then Rossi was in the hunt and Marquez was still winning and things got really, really bad.
I think it's like having a lit match over a barrel of kerosene. I think it would not take much to blow that team up.
And these two hit each other on track, boom.
Yeah. It would not take much. They're two very volatile personalities. They're two guys that have their hearts on their sleeve. They're not afraid to say what they mean. They are very aggressive on track when they have to be.
Oh, we love it.
But that's the beauty of the team. That's the beauty of Tichita, and they're on the knife edge. And like that's like I have a feeling that that might be the only way they don't win this championship.
That's the thing about this series and the difference between look. If Mercedes's car wasn't as good as it was from 2014 to 2016, and Rosberg and Lewis had the relationship that they have, that could have very easily put their championships in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. Here, mm-hmm. we have a similar situation. Diaz Tichita is a fantastic team with a great car and two very good drivers who probably don't get along too well behind the scenes.
And not to mention as well, it's got to suck for Vern to be beaten by a first-year teammate in a team that he partially owns.
Yeah. He's co-owner. People forget
this
that.
This is the house he helped build. And DaCosta walked right in and took his couch.
It's like your macho man Randy Savage watching Hulk Hogan hot dog in the ring.
Things changed drastically because, two seasons ago, we were talking about, hey, Jeff might have just tried to fix one of the New York E-Prix races.
2 years is a long time in motorsport.
we loved his bromance with Andre Lotterer when they were teammates. This is a very, very different dynamic.
Different times. So those are your runners and riders for the 2021 Formula E World Championship that we can say for the first time. Before we go, team driver championships, I'm going to go around the horn, so let's go RJ first, and I'll go clockwise.
I think the team's championship stays at Diaz Tichita.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that the driver's championship stays with Antonio Felix DaCosta, the special one. The Portuguese superstar athlete that's not going to let you down as a person, we hope. That's about the only sure things that I know about this season while we're still putting the calendar as we're going along in the season.
It's open. Cam, what do you reckon?
We know what team you're gonna pick.
No, I'm not. I think for the team.
Pick him, you coward.
Fuck you. I think that the team's championship stays at Diaz Tichita. I'm gonna go a little spicy on my driver's pick. I think Rene Rast.
Oh wow. Rast all the way. Okay. Interesting. King.
I hate to say it, But I agree with Cam. Teams to Cheetah. Wow. Drivers Rene Rast. He's gonna bring he's gonna bring the scythe out. He's gonna bring the scythe out.
Just Goku.
I did not think I was going to have anyone agree with. I didn't think I was going to have any allies with that pick.
Wow. So, for the first time, maybe in the history of a four man booth of Motorsport 101, Cam and King agreed on something. Truly dark times here, folks. Me? Again, I'm going to stick with. It's going to be a clean sweep teams wise. I think DS Chitita will win the team's title. But I think Jeff takes his title back.
Ooh.
I just have this gut feeling on Jeff. I think Jeff is not going to want to tolerate getting beaten by a man that stole his lunch money twice in a row. Like,
I see that as well, because I think Jeff is a driver who is always better when he has something motivating him.
Yes.
And now he has it.
He's a heart-on-sleeve driver, and I like heart-on-sleeve drivers. They're fun, quite frankly. So, yeah, we all are in agreement on DSGT for the teams, but three different driver picks. We have RJ keeping with DaCosta, the bottom row all saying Rene Rast for the driver's title, and me saying Jeff. This is going to be a fascinating season to watch, and as mentioned, it all starts next weekend, and by the time you're probably watching it this weekend, in Riyadh. On February 26th, we'll be back to review that then, early March, so looking forward to that as well. I guess it really is mainstream motorsport season's opener, I guess you could say, on that one. But yeah, can't wait to see how this season goes. We really aren't exaggerating when we say we think there's easily 14 cars in this field that can win a race at any given point, and that's going to be absolutely fascinating to watch. Let's wrap this up. Facey, you can find us one more time if you're watching us on YouTube. Hi, subscribe, hit the bell if you liked us. All of that good stuff. Our Twitter handles are on the screen right now if you're watching us on there. If not, at Harrison101HD, at RJ O'Connell for RJ, at Ryan Eric King for King, and CBuckley917. The podcast itself is on Motorsport_101. Also, I love that RJ's still waving like it's an episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire when they go through the guys on the road. It's like, just wait for the next 30 seconds. It's great. We're on Facebook.com/Motorsport101. We're on Instagram at Motorsport101Pod. And we're on Patreon.com/Motorsport101 if you'd like to back us financially on there. $5 gets you early access to all of the audio episodes of the show and anything we've caught up of until we're back on normal pace. $10 for the video versions of all our new shows and the supporters club of our Discord server. Thanks to everyone in there that's been watching along for the last hour 40. It's been a marathon edition this time round, but it was very, very fun indeed. Thanks everyone for tuning in. We'll be back, I want to say, in a couple of weeks' time, most likely to... Yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time to review the opening doubleheader weekend in Riyadh for the Formula E season debut, and we're probably going to preview the F1 season pretty soon as well, because we'll have testing rolling up the week after, so that should be fun. So, until then, I've been Andre Harrison, they've been RJ O'Connell, Ryan Eric King, and Cam Buckley. Stay safe out there, Texas, and until then, thanks for watching and listening. Sayonara.
Later, y'all!
Bye!
Pascal Wehrlein to win 3 races.
And, oh lord, and just in case anyone was annoyed, yes, we know, it's pronounced Riyadh.
That's always confused me. Like, I'm really bad at pronunciations, okay? It's one of these things that just happens.
Yeah, don't you hate it when you put the emphasis on the wrong syllable?